We move now to the third case of the day, 04-4114, Elima Abdullah versus the City of Madison et al. Mr. Lobey.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is John Lobey and I represent the appellants here. Your honors, this was not a summary judgment case. If all of the inferences were drawn properly in our favor, then the proper conclusion that a jury could have drawn is that Jamal Muhammad was literally crushed to death by the police that day. He suffered extremely traumatic injuries that we can infer weren't present on his body before the takedown. And to accept our argument, you need to accept two premises. The first premise is undisputed, and that is that Jamal Muhammad died of massive, massive tissue trauma to both the neck and the chest area.
Most of these kind of cases that we see, the excessive force cases when there's a death involved, involve police shootings, beatings with clubs or batons or something like that. In this case, it doesn't seem that there is anything more than an effort to restrain and subdue a man who was struggling right up to the end.
We have no problem with their takedown of Mr. Muhammad. In fact, I concede it was proper procedure, and they concede that the takedown was peaceful. The problem we have, Your Honor, is that once he was taken down, and everybody concedes the police did nothing that could have caused injury up to that non-controversial point, they continued the application of force, and they continued it in a way that caused massive trauma, a collapsed lung, more hemorrhaging in the neck than the autopsy pathologist had ever seen in his entire career. You've got this, the emphysema issue where his lung has been damaged. Massive, massive amounts of injuries. And if you accept their story, there's no dispute that none of those injuries were happened during the proper part of the encounter, during the part where the police corralled him, put him on the ground. Nothing even approaching these injuries happened up to that point in time. So circumstantially, the inference that the jury should be allowed to draw in this case is that those injuries happened after he had already been placed on the ground. And how is it that you can make that jump? And that's where we think the district court went astray. We presented the medical evidence from Dr. Edelman. And Dr. Edelman, nobody has any problem with his credentials. He has impeccable credentials. He's certainly qualified to make the opinions he made. And he opined that Jamal Muhammad did not have these injuries until after the takedown. What are his bases? First of all, there's the devastating testimony of the Madison police officers. Jamal Muhammad exhibited no injuries. They were in close proximity to him. They were interacting with him. There was nothing wrong with his breathing. There was nothing infirm about him. There was nothing at all consistent with this massive injury set that his body ends up with.
Now, he was about 5'8", 158 pounds. Is there evidence in the record as to the size of Officer Brooks and the other officers?
He's actually 5'6", Your Honor. Smaller than myself, and I'm not a big guy, let the record reflect. I don't know that the record has evidence about the size of the other police officers, but if you add all six together, I can guarantee you they're bigger than Jamal Muhammad. And there's no suggestion that Jamal was anything other than a weak man, a frail man. Nobody ever suggested he was exhibiting disproportionate strength. If you want to look at the law enforcement interests for using the kind of force that could have created these injuries, it's almost nil. And that's where we presented the police practices expert, Mr. Waller. Once he's been subdued on the ground, face down, with a pain technique, an arm twisted behind his back, surrounded by three police officers, six if you count the other three that felt there was no need to get any closer. You got a guy sitting basically on his backside. You got two police officers, one on either side. He was presenting a threat to no one at that point, to no one. And the fact is, he also was a disturbed person, and the district court sidestepped that altogether. But what police practices Waller told you, expert testimony, was that when someone like Brooks knows that the decedent had trouble understanding English and knows that someone like the decedent is prone to episodes, that that's a factor that should go into excessive force and the Graham, you know, reasonableness analysis. And nobody's suggesting that this court should hold that that means per se the force was unreasonable, but other courts have held that that's a factor. And it wouldn't apply if the officer had no reason to know it, but here Brooks had had prior encounters with Muhammad, and he had reason to know that the decedent had trouble with the English language and was prone to these kind of episodes. So if Jamal Muhammad had a powerful interest in being free of the kind of force that could have contributed to these kinds of injuries on his body, then law enforcement is going to need an equally powerful interest to have continued to use force after he was already prone on the ground. And after he was on the ground, there was no interest to use force, much less the type of force that could have produced the massive trauma that all the doctors agree was existing.
We're talking about an extremely short period of time here.
Extremely, maybe 2 minutes.
At the most.
Right.
And the nurse who stopped to help him originally and then was attacked by him was there during the whole time. And her opinion was that she didn't see anything unusual that the police did. Where was she when the last minute of this confrontation took place?
We have to concede she was at the scene. But, you know, where the district court went wrong is that I believe the nurse. Maybe it's because she was acting as a Samaritan. Maybe because she's a nurse. Maybe she was sympathetic. But that's not how it works for summary judgment. Just because the only non-police witness backed the police doesn't justify summary judgment. We were entitled to the circumstantial case that the nurse, who had an obvious motive not to like the decedent, she got punched in the face. I mean, we're going to argue to the jury that, you know, she has a reason to slant her testimony. The fact is, nobody can explain how this man went from a man who had no injuries to a man who died from massive trauma. And you want to talk about evidence on the other side of the equation, look at Brooks's own description of what happened. After they got Jamal Muhammad, peaceful takedown, no injuries up to that point, he's face down on the ground with an arm twisted snugly behind his back. He can't move. He can't threaten anybody. Brooks tells you he got on Muhammad's back and applied pressure. Now, we now know that Jamal Muhammad was dying an asphyxial death. He was being traumatic asphyxiation. The air was being compressed out of his lungs. What Brooks tells you is that Muhammad tried to stretch his head up, arching up, and we know now that the feeling he was experiencing is akin to drowning. He was being squashed to death. He's struggling for air. Brooks tells you, I proceeded to increase pressure. I was trying to make him stop squirming. He has told you he used excessive force. There's no legitimate law enforcement justification that could have justified squishing a man so that he stops squirming and then he never gets up. And that's, you know, that's direct evidence. That's out of Brooks' own mouth. He continued to apply pressure until decedent finally stopped moving altogether. And then he got off, and the decedent never got up. He didn't have these injuries before he went down. He had massive injuries after they found his body, and he never got up after Brooks got off him. Granted, that is a circumstantial case, because the witness who could have told our side of the story is dead. They killed him. But the law is supposed to weigh all kinds of evidence equally, and I feel that where the district court went wrong...
That seems to be the issue here, really. Judge Crabb analyzed the testimony of all the eyewitnesses, and I think rather carefully, and concluded from their testimony that the police didn't do anything that was unreasonable under the circumstances. But your position has got to be that balanced against that is the circumstantial evidence that derived from the testimony primarily of Edelman.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that
should we weigh that against the eyewitnesses?
Absolutely.
Or shouldn't we? Isn't that the issue here?
That's exactly the issue. And it's easier to get your arms around direct evidence. You know, if the police officer is going to tell you their story, that's more salient, more tangible. But under the law, the circumstantial evidence is every bit as powerful. And the case law, in fact, says you can infer the existence of excessive force, of more force than the police are willing to acknowledge, from the existence of serious injuries. And there's no explanation in the record of how this man went from having no injuries to having massive trauma that killed him, other than the circumstantial evidence.
And of course, if we didn't have Edelman's testimony and it was just the officers and the nurse,
then we have a problem.
Right.
But let's look
you
at
would have a, Big problem.
I have a problem, but I don't, because I do have Edelman's testimony, and I just want to tick off his other bases. Not only was the fact that nobody, that the police officers didn't observe any problems, and that you can't have that injury set without observing problems, but also the resistance attributed to him during the encounter, Edelman says flat out couldn't happen if you've got a collapsed lung and massive hemorrhaging in your neck and the subcutaneous emphysema. The fact that actions they attribute to him proves that he couldn't have had that injury set prior to the takedown, and therefore he acquired it after the takedown, notwithstanding their description of their actions. He also relies on the fact that the decedent went from his knees to a standing position, a very athletic move before the takedown. Couldn't do that with this injury set. The recent and bloodied injuries, and then finally, probably the most persuasive fact to me is the fact that one of the two causes of death was being smothered to death. It was traumatic asphyxiation killed him. And maybe I'm missing something, but how can you die of traumatic asphyxiation, of having your chest compressed and losing all the air, and then get up and have an encounter with the police officers? Certainly, we have made a sufficiently circumstantial case that should have gone to a jury. If you're going to, you know, this court's proposed jury instructions say that you're allowed to make inferences from facts. Bald speculation, like in the Phillips case, bad. But clearly, it is okay to take a fact and deduce another fact from that fact. And if we were going to get all inferences in our favor, we should have had a trial. And I just want to say one more word about the failure to intervene quickly. It's no coincidence that the Madison appellees went all for that there was no excessive force. But once you conclude that Brooks could, in fact, be liable for that excessive force, it's a very small jump to that these officers who literally held the decedent down while he was killed are liable under this court's case law for failure to intervene under cases like Yang and the district courts interpreting it. An opportunity to have prevented the harm is all that is needed, and clearly these Madison police officers, who coincidentally are saying they were too busy with his arms and his legs to have actually seen what Brooks was doing, they had more than an opportunity to say during that 2 minutes, get off of him, you're killing him. So we ask you to reverse the case against both and permit a trial. Thank you.
Dunsky. May it please the court, my name is John Glinsky and I represent Officer Brooks. I believe the plaintiffs place too much reliance on Dr. Edelman's opinion. Dr. Edelman's opinion was that the fatal injuries that were inflicted upon Jamal Muhammad occurred during his encounter with the police. But Dr. Edelman does not blame any particular officer. He does not ascribe those injuries to any particular officer. He does not suggest that there's a reasonable inference that any particular officer inflicted the injuries.
No, but we've got other evidence as to what officer was doing what. I mean, it's...
Well, the only evidence, Your Honor...
Look at the other evidence for that point.
The only evidence is that Officer Brooks had his knee and his shin on Muhammad's right shoulder blade. And not even Dr. Edelman opines that that would have been sufficient to inflict the fatal injuries on Mr. Muhammad.
So you're saying that the medical expert would have had to specifically identify the officer that did a specific act in order to get past summary judgment?
Well, at least there has to be some other evidence other than Dr. Edelman's opinion, because Dr. Edelman doesn't indicate that Officer Brooks did anything wrong. There's nothing in Dr. Edelman's report that suggests that Officer Brooks did anything wrong.
Of course, Dr. Edelman wasn't there either. I mean,
that's right.
Testimony.
But he had read all the depositions, the autopsy report. He had all the information that would be available to the jury. And if Dr. Edelman would have to have guessed that it was Officer Brooks, then the jury would have to speculate that it was Officer Brooks as well. I don't believe Dr. Edelman's opinion can be stretched to create a reasonable inference that Officer Brooks inflicted the fatal injuries.
How could Mr. Abdullah have suffocated if it wasn't from the force applied to his back?
Well, Dr. Bauman believes that it occurred prior to the encounter with the police, and Dr. Huntington believes it could have occurred prior.
So isn't that a conflict then in the testimony, and therefore there's a material dispute, and so summary judgment shouldn't have been granted?
Well, there's only...
The district court weighing then the opinions of the various doctors?
Your Honor, I believe there's only a material or dispute of material issue if a jury could reasonably infer that it was Officer Brooks who inflicted the fatal injuries. And I don't see that.
In fact, there's something else the court should consider, which I don't think the district court placed enough emphasis on, and the appellant sort of dismissed. But I had indicated in the district court that the plaintiff here had dismissed the Madison police officers, indicated that, admitted that they did not use excessive force. But this was not a stipulated dismissal. What the plaintiff did is indicate in a brief filed in the district court that there was insufficient evidence to proceed against the Madison officers and that judgment should be entered indicating as much. Therefore, since summary judgment can be entered only when there's no issue of material fact, that constitutes a judicial admission that there was no reasonable inference that could be drawn that the Madison officers did it. But if that's true, the same has to be true of Officer Brooks. The reason for that is because there's no more evidence that Officer Brooks inflicted the injuries than there is any of the other officers. Now, the response from the plaintiff to that is, well, Officer Brooks, though, is the one who had his knee on Muhammad's right shoulder blade. But there's no evidence in the record, and no one contends that that in and of itself could have inflicted the injuries. And there's no evidence that Officer Brooks did anything other than that.
I guess that he did it than that somebody who didn't have his knee on the Muhammad's back did it, isn't there?
The plaintiff's other response, Your Honor, is, well, Officer Brooks is lying. He actually, instead of just having it on his shoulder blade, moved his knee and he had it on his spine, and then he moved it and he had it on his neck, and all long enough to inflict all this damage and to suffocate Muhammad.
Right.
There's no evidence.
If none of the officers did it, did Mr. Abdullah do this to himself?
I'm not saying none of it.
How this could have happened. I mean, Brooks was the only one there. He was the only one applying pressure. And if you're saying he didn't do it, and there's the medical testimony is not disputed in terms of what the man died from, so what happened? Did he just do it to himself?
Well, Your Honor, though, in a 1983 action, you have to prove cause. You can't just say one of these people must have done it.
Yeah, but doctors can, I mean, an expert can certainly opine that the plaintiff didn't do it himself. I mean, he didn't create his own injury.
Yes.
And the expert here talked about what the man died from. And if he couldn't do it himself and there was an officer there who applied pressure and there's no indication that he had these problems prior to, although you say that's disputed because of the other doctors, right. But that's the whole reason you have trials, isn't it?
Well, but you can't, Your Honor, say that a reasonable inference is created that Officer Brooks inflicted these fatal injuries when Dr. Edelman's report does not indicate that it was Officer Brooks, and there's no other evidence to suggest it. The only evidence is that, and this is undisputed.
But what Dr. Edelman had to rely on was what Brooks said in his deposition. And so you're assuming that what Brooks said that Dr. Edelman has to take that as gospel. I mean, that's all that's there. If it were a jury could make the finding that Brooks was lying. That's not the call that Edelman has to make. Edelman has to make the call, you know, looking at the deposition testimony as it is for his expert opinion.
But that's the point, Your Honor. The jury could determine that Brooks is lying, but the jury could also determine that the Madison police officers are lying. But the plaintiff has judicially admitted that that inference cannot reasonably be drawn with respect to the Madison police officers based on Dr. Edelman's report. If it can't be drawn with respect to them, it can't be drawn with respect to Officer Brooks because there's no more evidence against that he inflicted the fatal injuries than the Madison police officers did. The district court summed it up quite well in indicating that the burden of proof here in establishing cause is on the plaintiff, and there simply is no evidence. The only evidence is that Officer Brooks had his knee on Muhammad's right shoulder blade for about 30 seconds or so. Dr. Edelman does not indicate that was sufficient. Dr. Edelman does not indicate Brooks did anything else, simply opines that the injuries must occur during the encounter with the police. But there's no other evidence. There's no evidence whatsoever that Officer Brooks inflicted these injuries. So the district court opinion should be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Kaiser?
Like one of the other counsel, I heard the argument of, as I sat in the gallery, I have outlines and timelines and prepared remarks, but your questions and other counsel's remarks have led me to make a list of things I feel I need to address. First of all, I want to pick up on something Judge Evans noted, which is that this case is not like a lot of cases before you alleging excessive force. You've read the cases in the briefs, and I think none of them are very much similar to this case. We're talking about an undisputed time period of about 2 minutes. And Mr. Lobey said that there were no injuries visible to this man before the police encountered him. And that's just not true. The nurse, Pam McCarty, who dealt with this man just seconds before the police got there, testified unambiguously, and she's qualified to do so. She's a nurse. That he was breathing heavily and staggering and having difficulty getting around while she was dealing with him. So I think that needs to be taken into account. She's an independent witness who observed this man just before police got there, and then she stood by within 6 feet of him and watched the police interaction as they tried to subdue him.
Yeah, well, we're talking about summary judgment. Right. I mean, that's summary just judgment. One observation among many, isn't
right,
it?
Right, right. But in addition to her views, there was another civilian witness standing by, Katrina Weinfurtner, whose testimony is also in the record. So this is not a case like several of them in the briefs where the only living witness alive to tell the story are the police actors who are being accused of putting excessive force on this man. In addition, Mr. Lobey said there's no suggestion anywhere in the record that this was not a weak man, that he was 5'6", and however many pounds, and I will tell you that I don't think there is anything in the record about the weights of the police officers involved in the takedown. But there is evidence in this record of his behavior before the takedown, and he may have been small and he may have been lightweight, but he was not weak. He was struggling. He was putting on a good fight with Pam McCarty before the police got there. And even once he was down on the ground, I again have to correct what Mr. Lobey said, once he was prone on the ground with Officer Brooks trying to get a compression hold on one of his wrists, he did not stop struggling. It's undisputed in this record. They admitted proposed findings of fact by both defendants that this man continued to kick, he continued to try to arch up. They needed two sets of handcuffs to get him handcuffed because the two officers could not get his hands behind his back because he was resisting. And again, I'll remind you, this is a time frame of 2 minutes going on. It's not like 17 minutes in one of the cases where three officers were putting their full body weight on a man while he was screaming that he couldn't breathe and they laughed at him. That is not this case. And the big picture needs to be kept in mind when you look at the facts. It's a very short time period, and these things are undisputed on summary judgment. The plaintiffs did not dispute that Officer Brooks' testimony was he had his knee or shin on Muhammad's right shoulder. There may be a dispute about whether it strayed to his back area for 30 seconds. 30 to 45 seconds is what we're talking about. And that leads me into the failure to intervene claim, which is the only thing that's alive anymore against my clients, the City of Madison officers. The failure to intervene claim hinges on there being something to intervene to stop. And it is undisputed again. My three officers' testimony, the only one that even was in a position to be observing what Brooks was doing, because Sergeant Grady was at the feet. He was there for about 4 minutes. He was struggling to keep the feet from kicking. Officer Mueller was at the feet. He was one of the last officers to arrive. He arrived with a minute left. He was struggling with the feet. His back was to Officer Brooks. Jessica Murphy was the only one next to Brooks. She had one arm and Brooks had the other. She observed this knee on the shoulder. She observed that there was nothing wrong with it. He wasn't, you know, jumping on the man. He wasn't putting his body weight on the man. He was putting enough weight just to control Muhammad until they could get the cuffs on. And again, it's undisputed on the summary judgment record that Officer Brooks got off of Muhammad as soon as the handcuffing was completed. And after the handcuffing was completed, he continued to kick, and that's why they needed to put the leg restraints on. And again, it's undisputed that there was nothing wrong with using leg restraints. I submit it as a very unfortunate accident, and it's tragic. I'd like to have the answers to what happened to this man. But another important legal point that can't get lost here is that we really need to reshape the inquiry. The question is not who gave these injuries to Muhammad. That's the medical question that Edelman gives you an opinion on. He says they had to have happened at the scene, and by the way, that is disputed. But it is not a material dispute of fact, because the inquiry on this case involving excessive force is not whether there was a medical cause in fact of injury. It's whether, in this case, as it's been distilled down to you on appeal, Officer Brooks's actions were objectively reasonable under all of the circumstances. That question is not addressed by Dr. Edelman. Dr. Edelman's opinion is nothing more than a basis for res ipsa loquitur kind of logic, which this court has rejected in Brownell and in Phillips. And despite all of the efforts of the plaintiffs...
Yeah, this isn't quite a res ipsa case, though, because we've certainly got a lot of testimony about what might have caused the injuries. And it's not a case of where the person is in great shape 1 minute and goes into the police station and comes out 2 hours later with all his legs broken.
Well, neither was Brownell.
It's a res ipsa case. But.
Brownell was a case, though, Judge, where the plaintiff did come into the emergency room from a car accident with the police in tow, was fully checked out by a doctor who opined either on the summary judgment record at trial. I can't remember whether Brownell went through a trial or not, but that emergency room doctor said, I checked him over fully. If that spinal fracture was there, I would have seen it, clearly leading to an inference that when the man woke up in county lockup the next morning, a quadriplegic, something had happened while he was in the exclusive control of the police.
Yeah,
and this court rejected that.
There wasn't any evidence of what happened specifically. That's my point.
Excuse me?
I say there wasn't any evidence of what the possible causes were, as there are here. You don't know anything about what happened to him specifically between one time and the one.
Well, I guess I respectfully disagree. In Brownell, the officers did testify to two different kind of pain hold techniques that someone had said might have aggravated his spinal condition. And the court found that it's not enough. You've got to have evidence of specific wrongdoing in an excessive force case. It's not like a negligence case. Negligence is not enough in an excessive force case. And I posit that Dr. Edelman's opinion, while it muddies the waters and makes you think about it very hard, it is not enough to get this plaintiff over the hump on summary judgment. It just doesn't get them there. And it certainly doesn't get them there on the failure to intervene claim, which is really all that they have left against my clients, who saw nothing to intervene against and therefore had no duty to say, stop, you're killing this man. And I think Mr. Lobey said, my officers presumably stood by for 2 minutes and said that. And again, the window here where we're talking about Officer Brooks being on this man's shoulder was 30 seconds. And during that 30 seconds, my officer, the only one of which was in a position to see that, was busy trying to get the man handcuffed herself and didn't think that Officer Brooks was applying anything but reasonable force. My red light is on. Unless you've got questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you. The fundamental premises are undisturbed. He didn't have these injuries before the takedown, if you give us all the reasonable inferences, and he died of massive trauma, and Brooks admits to being on his back, admits to putting downward pressure. That's enough for a jury. I'm going to rebut quickly the points they made. My opponent talked about the nurse. She says he's breathing heavy. The police officers say he's not breathing heavy. They saw no problems with his breathing. Maybe he was breathing during the struggle, but we're entitled to say let a jury decide who to believe, the nurse or the Madison police officers. They have another witness, Katrina Weinfurter. She says he was being aggressive on the ground. Of course, we now know he was struggling to stay alive. That doesn't change any of the fundamental premises, and it doesn't, you know, we've cited case law. You don't just count up the witnesses. The fact that both non-police witnesses are backing them does not mean we don't get a trial. He said, my opponent says he was struggling. He never stopped struggling, and he was continuing to kick when he was on the ground. We now know he was struggling to remain alive. And the fact is, they didn't touch my argument. He had his arm behind his back. He was face down on the ground. They had three officers around him and three more who were radioing back. He's under control. They didn't even feel the need to get involved. There's no requirement that somebody has to stop moving altogether. And that's how Brooks, an untrained police officer, treated this encounter. He was going to keep squishing until this guy stopped, in his word, squirming. And that force was excessive. There was no justification to use the kind of force that could have produced these injuries. Mr. Glinski talks about the 30 seconds... Actually, both of them referred to the 30 seconds. It was 30 to 45 seconds or so by their admission. Could have been closer to a minute. And what we do know, Your Honors, is it was long enough to kill Jamal Muhammad. because he went from an alive person to a dead person, and he went undisputedly with massive traumatic injuries all over his body, that if you credit Edelman's opinion, and they haven't really challenged that there's at worst a dispute of fact on that, those injuries happened after the takedown. My opponent keeps coming back to all Brooks said was he only admitted was a shoulder blade, a knee on the shoulder blade. We'll never know if his knee migrated 4 inches farther to the north because we weren't there. But we certainly can infer it circumstantially because there's all kinds of trauma on his neck that they can't account for. More hemorrhaging in the neck than the autopsy pathologist has ever seen in his entire career. We don't have to credit Brooks' testimony that it remained there during this entire fluid situation. They say that there's a dispute about the from the doctors of whether these injuries were there prior, but that's not quite accurate. Dr. Huntington, the autopsy pathologist hired by Brooks to be his Rule 26 expert, says he has no opinion about whether the injuries happened prior to the takedown. So you have Dr. Edelman with his 5 strong reasons why he couldn't have had this injury set prior to the takedown. You have Dr. Huntington saying, I have no opinion on that. And you have, of course, Dr. Bauman relying on that sort of goofy reenactment, taking a different position, and the jury will decide who to believe. I'm not even going to address the false logic that because we chose to go only against Brooks, that means we lose. That's addressed in our brief. It's false logic, and it's obviously not persuasive. On the failure to intervene claim, there was... They argued, well, Grady was only there for 4 minutes, Mueller was only there for 1 minute. There was time. They were on the ground for at least 2 minutes, and Jamal Muhammad went from an alive person to a dead person. He went from someone squirming, struggling to breathe, to someone who totally stopped moving. Under this court's very clear case law, there was a reasonable opportunity to prevent the harm. It's telling that in their position is, well, we were too distracted with his feet to notice what Brooks was doing. They're going to have to tell that to the jury. They were close enough to have seen what was going on. At the end, our 3 premises remain. The Brunell case is not this case. I just say one word about the Brunell case. This court was very clear. No evidence of excessive force. We're not saying you should just race ipsa negligence.
Up.
But in that case, there was no evidence of excessive force. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, both sides, for the vigorous presentations. We'll take the case under advisement, proceed to...